William Bartling was 70 years of age. He was hospitalized, bedridden, in constant pain. He was being maintained on various life support systems. One day, Mr. Bartling summoned the hospital personnel to his side, and he asked them to remove him from the tubes, from the life support system. The administration of the hospital refused, and Bartling summoned his lawyer. The lawyer prepared a document for submission to the California court. It's the hospital, the Glendale Seventh-day Adventist Medical Center was, of course, in that state. And Bartling somehow managed to sign the document. The document was scheduled for appearance before a judge. There was some delay in that appearance. 3 months after the signing of the document, Bartling was to get his day in court. And the day before his document, his petition was submitted, which would have forced the hospital to remove him from this mechanical system, he died, having suffered for 3 months because of the unwillingness of the hospital to act on his request. Bartling's case, which was reported at length some months ago in the New York Times, is another instance of a growing number of episodes in which patients in a hospital who are there because they are paying the hospital to do certain things for them are refused by that hospital in their requests for release. The hospital is not necessarily acting in terms of high moral principle. Probably, though one cannot know it, the major concerns of the administrators are that no one in the patient's family might ever sue them for malpractice. They may also be concerned that some of the hospital personnel may have very rigid views about the purposes of a hospital, the medical profession, to prolong life at all costs. And they may have a number of staff problems, even a suit initiated by the staff. Or they may be concerned that some agency of the federal or the state government might intrude into the operation of the hospital, as the federal government did in the case of Baby Doe, and accuse the hospital of malfeasance or nonfeasance. In any case, a growing number of elderly people have been speaking to me of their fear of entering a hospital. And they're not afraid in any primitive way of medicine. But what they fear is their loss of their ability or the ability of those who stand in for them to manage a quiet, calm, dignified death. They fear that they will become prisoners of a system, system which has not yet worked its way through to an understanding of whether or not there is a right to die, and if so, how this right to die should be exercised, when, and under what conditions. And I'm sure that many of us, as well as many medical personnel, have not thought through carefully, soberly, our own feelings about this really major new concern which troubles all of us. Just a few weeks ago, a family told me that they had sent away the rescue squad with the ambulance, which had been summoned to their parents' apartment by a well-intentioned neighbor, when the father, the grandfather, who was dying of heart failure, had another seizure, because they wanted to allow him what they had been working to achieve all along, a calm and dignified death. They didn't want him subjected to the emergency procedures, the heroic measures, it's an interesting euphemism, that would be attempted if he were sent down to the local hospital. Now, as you know, Most of the religious traditions of the world, certainly those in the West, have major taboos about suicide. Life is a gift to us of God. Life is precious, sacred. And we ought to do all that we can to sustain life, to maintain our health, to preserve life. But one has to wonder whether the continuation of something called life for a patient who would not survive outside of a mechanical contrivance is in fact a prolongation of life or a prolongation of dying. And I would submit that these are two very different concepts. Now, I understand and I affirm the sacredness of life, and so, of course, does our tradition. But it's interesting that when you review our tradition, you find that nowhere in that great rabbinic compendium we call the Talmud is suicide spelled out or declared to be a heinous sin. And that when you look at the Bible itself, you discover that there are a number of instances in which someone commits suicide and that someone is never arbitrarily condemned or damned for having done so. When the tribes entered the Holy Land and began to complete the conquest of the country, they were immediately faced by a new foe, the Sea Peoples, the Philistines, people who had been dispossessed by the Greeks as they moved down from the north across Greece and Crete, and who had come by ship to attack the Egyptian and the Canaanite coasts. And the Israelites fought as best they could against the Philistines, and was only under the leadership of Saul that they began to be able to withstand the attacks of the Philistines, who had a kind of technical superiority because they had learned to use iron-tipped weapons and iron wheels on their chariots in a way that no other country of the time had done. In any case, Saul fought manfully and to some degree successfully against the Philistines. But in one of the battles, he was grievously wounded. And in the Bible, in the book of Samuel, we're told that at that point, Saul appealed to his young armor bearer. And he said to him, "Run your sword through me and kill me, lest the Philistines run their swords through me and make sport of me." And according to the book of Samuel, this young armor bearer was afraid to raise his sword to the king. So Saul seized his own sword and fell upon it and killed himself. And nowhere is there any indication that he is condemned for this act. Indeed, the rabbis, when they comment on it in the Midrash, speak of extenuating and mitigating circumstances. Now, language is often very revealing. Our word is suicide, which comes, of course, from the Latin sui, to do it to oneself, and side, which means essentially to kill oneself. It's a generic term, broad. Any killing of oneself, any act against oneself would be suicide. The Hebrew term is a much more specific term, la'abed atzmo la'da'at, to take one's life, la'da'at, in full knowledge of what one is doing. The opposite is shelo la'da'at. Well, that means without being in full control of one's senses, without being under stress, being in deep depression. The Hebrew term begins to suggest very strongly that there are all kinds of mitigating circumstances that one ought to consider, all kinds of extenuating circumstances which must be considered before a death is declared to be a suicide. The first serious examination of the question of suicide occurs in a collection known as Evel Rabbati, the Great Book of Mourning, which is a collection of laws dealing with mourning, death, grief, and so on, compiled just at the end or slightly beyond the end of the Talmudic period in the 5th, 6th centuries. We're not quite sure when. And in this book, the rabbis ask the question, who is a suicide? And they answer by giving a number of examples. They say, if a man climbs a tree or if he climbs on a roof and jumps off the roof, that's not by itself prima facie evidence of suicide. A suicide is one who climbs up to a tree, a tall tree, or climbs on a roof, and he declares loudly, I am going to kill myself. I know that this is against the law, and then jumps. Now that's a suicide. Because he is one, she'abed atzmo ladat. He gives evidence that he knows what he's doing. In other words, from the very beginning, there's a search to define suicide in a very narrow and very limited kind of way. And the point I want to make this morning is very simply this, that in all the areas that are problem areas that medicine and with all of its miracles and wonders is creating for us, Judaism in its traditional form may not provide specific answers, but the approach, which is a Jewish approach, is one that I would submit to you has great merit. It begins with an abhorrence of simplicity, an abhorrence of the simple general terms which seem to explain everything, but in fact explain nothing. Life is sacred. We all agree. But what is life? When does life cease to be life? Is a brain-dead person whose heart and whose lungs are being kept churning by some kind of machine alive? Life needs to be defined. And the acts which are to be declared sacred need to be defined. Does someone who performs heroic measures on a body of an elderly person who has no chance of coming back into their control of their lives have some the dignity of consciousness and mobility? Is that an act which is a sacred act, an act committed to the preservation of life? There's an old rabbinic phrase which I want to commend to you this morning. Ein am haaretz chassid, which the rabbis in the end interpreted to mean that an innocent person, a simple person, one who doesn't think, cannot be a saint. You've got to think with your head as well as your heart. The person who knows what's right, just knows, is certain, is more often wrong than right, especially when they deal with these very difficult problems which modern medicine faces us with. Now, I understand the taboo, and you understand the taboo against suicide. It's not unusual for people to fall into deep depressions. And when they're in the slough of despond, it's hard for them to see that there's any light at the end of the tunnel, that there'll be dawn after the darkness. And so society conspires to try to get them through the dark night, because in fact, if we can get them to the morning, we may even have a day like this, something beyond the Cleveland winter. But at the same time, there are situations, are there not, in which death, in a classic sense, may be preferable to life. And I've always been intrigued by the fact that the very religious traditions, which are the most adamant, the most simplistic, in their definition of life and of death and their condemnation of suicide, are precisely those traditions which make the greatest virtue of martyrdom. Now, there are martyrs who have no choice. Most of the Jews of Europe were killed simply because they were Jews. They didn't have the choice of renouncing Judaism and live. But many of the martyrs of the past, the early Christians in Roman times, were given the choice. Renounce your faith and live. And they're worshipped and venerated as martyrs because they chose to die. And what is suicide in those general terms but the choice of death over life? Now, their heroism is commendable, but should suggest to us at the very least that we need a more careful understanding, more sophisticated understanding of suicide than that which is general in our society. Now, Jews, as you know, had all kinds of taboos against suicide. Presumably, if a person committed suicide, there was not to be any kind of chesped of eulogy at their funeral. Presumably, they would be buried at the outer fringes of the cemetery. But it's interesting when you read through the case histories, the response of the rabbis, how unwilling most of them were ever to point the finger. Again and again, they quote Rabbi Akiba, who once overheard his disciples condemning somebody who had committed suicide and who said to them, leave him in silence. Neither curse him nor bless him. Medicine is evolving with such speed. The issues are so complex that this is not a period in history where we're going to be able to find general, simple, straightforward rules which will cover any and all circumstance. And so it's a good time to remind ourselves of the Jewish way of going about ethical thought, reminding ourselves that simplicity is not a virtue, and that though we respect and revere life and are grateful to God for the gift of life and will do all that we can to sustain something which has quality and capacity and ability, there are limits. There's times when dying is being prolonged rather than living. You know, despite all the taboos, we venerate, in our religious tradition, at least Samson, who committed suicide. He was chained, as you recall, to the walls of the temple, the Philistine temple, and he was being tormented, and he pulled apart the pillars and pulled down the roof of the temple into killing his tormentors with himself, but he committed essentially suicide. And where do we go when we visit Israel? Where do they take us? They take us to Matsada. And what is Matsada? Great palace of Herod, where a group of zealots fortified themselves during the revolt against Rome. And what happened at Matsada? They defied the Roman legions for a long time, but when that ramp came up almost to the walls, and when they knew that further defense was impossible, they committed suicide. All of them. And we respect that heroism. And when we read the records of the Holocaust, we recognize that there were any number of leaders in the Jewish community who, when ordered by the Germans to make out registers of those Jews who ordered to be deported that week to the death camp, committed suicide rather than sending fellow Jews to their death. And we can understand and empathize and indeed commend that kind of action. Judaism abhors, in its ethical thinking, simplicity. Life is a golden word, but what does it mean to support life, to hold life sacred in a given and very specific circumstance? Let me suggest another area where you can see the Jewish approach, first the approach rather than the substance, which I am pleading with you this morning to consider. In another tradition, various other traditions, where the definitions of life and are very simple and straightforward, life is said to begin with conception. And therefore, any taking of a fetus is held to be murder. Now, the traditional Jewish attitude towards abortion is a relatively restrained one. But it's very interesting that from the beginning, the rabbis made a distinction between the existence of the fetus and the ability of an individual to sustain life on their own. Life, in its fullest sense, came into being only postpartum. And therefore, when the choice had to be made between the life of the mother and the life of the fetus, there was no choice. If the mother's life was endangered, the mother's life was protected because the mother was alive in the fullest sense of the word. The fetus was not yet fully alive. And this ability, again, to make these kinds of sophisticated distinctions between an incomplete existence and full life in its fullness is the kind of distinction for which I am pleading this morning. I would not argue that the traditional approach, the traditional rabbinic approach, as expounded by the rabbis today, is necessarily the best approach towards the question of abortion. They take a very relatively narrow view, even though one could find in the tradition terms like the endangerment of life, which would allow a broader view if they did not feel so threatened by the pace of change in our society. But the point is, from the very beginning, they examined terms, life, death, preservation of life, and they tried to see what it would mean in a specific circumstance. The general principle, of course, but always looking for the circumstance, looking to see what the particular issue may be. And when we reflect on the past and its generalities, we ought to have the courage also to reflect on the present, our present and our generalities. A great deal is made today of a new term. It's called the quality of life. And by the quality of life, people tend to mean almost anything. For some, the quality of life means a distinction between somebody being kept alive barely on a life support system and letting them go. For others, the quality of life means complete capacity, complete mobility. Every once in a while, you read in the paper of someone who in their early 70s or so, when the eye begins to dim and the hearing begins to harden and the stairs begin to seem like Mount Everest, when they take their lives because they're afraid their life will not have any quality to it. Obviously, some distinctions have to be made. What do we mean by the quality of life? Were the Germans right when they went through the old folks' homes and just did away with all who were there because their life had no quality to it? That's not the reason they gave, of course. There were people who were taking from the state when everybody had to give to the state. One could make the argument that once one is parasitic and confined to a wheelchair, there's really very little quality to life. I'll give you several for instances which should give us pause. In the early part of the century, there was a very interesting German Jewish philosopher by the name of Franz Rosenzweig. Franz Rosenzweig, when he was about 35 years of age, just after the First World War, contracted a fatal bone disease, which was totally paralytic. And in 1921, he was bedridden, and in the subsequent months, he lost control of his limbs. He could no longer move his limbs. He could hardly speak. He managed to communicate by pointing to a typewriter board, which would then spell out his wife or someone who was at the bedside what he wanted to do. And he lived in that condition for another 8 years. And during this period of time, though he was living essentially on a mattress grave, he translated, annotated, and produced a volume of translations of the poetry of Judah Halevi. And he began with Martin Buber, a translation into German, a new translation of the Bible, which would express their understanding of the meetings between God and man, which the Bible represents. And he and Buber, working this way, got through as far as the book of Isaiah. All this done in a mattress grave. All this done by a man who objectively, I suspect most of the people who talk so glibly about the quality of life would declare that his life had no quality. A few years ago, a distraught woman came to see me. Her mother, who had been a woman, a very proud woman, almost a vain woman, had been in her mid-70s, had taken an overdose of sleeping pills. She committed suicide. She feared aging. She feared the loss of the quality of life. And the daughter was distraught. My mother never trusted me. I wanted so much to take care of her, to help her, to bring her into our home. I wanted to share life, her needs, as she had shared mine. She never gave me a chance. She never trusted me to take care of her. There was so much we wanted to talk about with her, so much we could have done. Now all this is denied me. Quality of life, when we apply it to ourselves, can be a very selfish term. Whatever it is, and there's some truth to talk of the quality of life, it needs, obviously, the most careful definition. Thinking is not easy. Mouthing platitudes is a relatively simple undertaking. We live in an era when life and death need to be redefined. We need a time when our legal system needs to examine the question whether there is a right to die and to remove those cases which would fall under that category from the area of possible suit under malpractice, so that the hospitals would not become, as they are becoming, a danger to us, our enemy, but would remain as we've generally thought of them, as a service or institution designed for our benefit. The medical profession needs to rethink its ultimate purposes. Is the doctor there to prolong something called life as long as the heart pumps, as long as the lungs breathe, as long as machines can sustain it, sustain us? Or must there be judicious and discriminating decisions, difficult decisions made? And who should make those decisions? And how much should our own desires enter into them? Have we not a right to say, genug, no more, it's enough? Do we, in effect, flaunt God's gracious gift to us of life when at some point we say, this is not life? I can't move. I can't control my bodily functions. I can hardly think. I can't remember. Enough. I know very few generalizations, as you know, which stand up to the test of thought. The one from our rabbinic tradition with which I suggested earlier, I would leave you with today. Remember it above all else. Lo am ha'aretz chasid. An innocent person, however well-intentioned, cannot be a saint. Amen.